goals. A journey into a world that is just beyond our comprehension. The world of the paranormal.
Welcome to the 13 Skulls. I'm your host, TJ. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at the world's oldest dinosaur embryo has been found, a piggy bank made from a real piglet, a backyard phantom, UK schools are doing UFO crash drills, the Pedro Mountain mummy, scientists change skin into blood, and robots have decided that humans taste like bacon. That and a lot more in this 49th episode of the 13 Skulls. Welcome back, everybody. I really appreciate you coming and taking a listen to the show. Let's go ahead and get the formalities buried in the dirt and out of the way. If you have an experience or feedback to share, email me at the13skulls@gmail.com or info@the13skulls.com. Or if you want to call in and tell me your feedback, you can call 206-338-2205 or 817-986-0019. Again, as always, there will be quite a few UFO sightings from ufoclearinghouse.webs.com that I will link to in the show notes at the13skulls.com. If you like the music in the show, it's courtesy of the IOTA PromoNet at iotaalliance.com. There are links to download them and buy them if you like them in the show notes for this episode at the13skulls.com. I'll provide links to everything you hear about in the show notes. I've been meaning to promote this for quite a long time, and I completely forgot to do it. I really apologize, Anthony, for the delay in actually getting the promotion out there for your work. Anthony was the original one who did the logo for the show. He did the 13 Skulls logo with the skull mixed in with the 13. I fell in love with it the first time that I saw it, and I think Anthony does really, really good work. He's really talented, and if you guys out there need any graphic design assistance or work whatsoever, and Anthony can help you, email him. You can email him at rampromos@aol.com. That's rampromos @aol.com. Anthony does great graphic design work, and if you need anything and he can help you out, I guarantee you'll be happy with what he does, because everything that I've seen him do has been stellar. It's been great work. So, Anthony, I really appreciate you doing the logo for the show, man, and hopefully we can, you know, get the word out there about your work. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. All All right, well, the first thing that I wanted to take a look at was an email that I got from Nick. He says, "Hey, man, I'm from Chesterfield, Michigan. My ghostly encounters began when I was about 9 years old, living in St. Helen, Michigan. My family had purchased a house from a middle-aged man in his early 30s. The only catch about the place was that the man's father had passed away in the home. And, of course, with my luck, I was the winner of the room that he had passed in. Little things in the house began happening, like footsteps, trinkets going missing and then reappearing, and my German Shepherd dog named Prince barking at what seemed to be nothing in different spots of the house. After chalking all these experiences up to be nothing, that's when, quote-unquote, scary things began happening. After waking up in the morning and finding glasses full of dirty water in the cupboards, the man's son told us he used to wear dentures. And before the old man slipped into bed, he would put his teeth in a glass and put them above the sink. If this wasn't enough to swallow at once, we began to hear what sounded like a parade with horses going up and down our hallway at night. My Uncle Bob stayed with us a few weeks, and he'd sleep in the spare bedroom. One morning, me and my mom were in the dining room about to eat breakfast when my uncle came full-fledged running out of the back of the house. He had a look of sheer terror in his eyes and face. The girl, he said, she choked me. We were confused about what he was saying. He said he was sleeping and all of a sudden he woke up and couldn't move. There was a lady with a black dress standing next to the bed. She said something to him which I don't remember, but she began choking him. After he had worked up enough strength to get up and run, he showed us his neck, and there, right above his Adam's apple, were two very distinct handprints. He moved out that day. But what I think is the most scariest thing and very personal was a copper cross on which Jesus hung. His head, of course, hung to the side, but you could leave the room, come back, and his head would be on the other shoulder. Not that it's right to throw religious items away, my mom was sure to get rid of that one, only to follow us to our next two houses. There are plenty of things that have happened in that house, but I'm going to wrap it up here. So, my mom got a hold of a Catholic priest to do a blessing on the home because she had mentioned there was a negative spirit there. He told her to get a tape recorder, let it sit in the home, and leave for a few hours. So, we did exactly that. My mom had set it up, pushed record, and we both walked out of the house. Not even within seconds of us shutting the door, on later playback, of course, we began to hear screaming, glass breaking, doors slamming, and some squeaking. To accompany these sounds was my dog Prince crying in his kennel the whole time. The priest did come out and bless the house, holding the activity steady for a year or so, but it picked back up. On a side note, I believe the house was a portal, and there was a lot of different emotions in different parts of the homes. Anyways, I love the show. Nick. Well, Nick, I really appreciate that you wrote into the show. I appreciate you that you listen. That's quite terrifying to have gotten EVPs of glass breaking and doors slamming and some squeaking. And what really kind of gave me goosebumps just now was that you were saying that your dog was crying in his kennel the whole time. Now, I have dogs of my own, and for them to be scared while I'm gone kind of creeps me out a little bit. And I think about that all the time. I think about what goes on while I'm not here. And that's pretty crazy, man. It really is. It's pretty wild that you've had that happen. If you have those recordings and you'd be willing to share them, I would love to hear them. Now, that's up to you. If you do have them and you want to share them, that's great. If you don't have them anymore, that's great too. That's fine. You know, I mean, things like that, they aren't kept for that long. But if you do have those recordings, I would love to hear them. And thank you again, Nick. I really, truly do appreciate you writing into the show. Now, the next thing that I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of ufocon.blogspot.com. There was some audio that was lifted from a meeting that was taken a while back, over four decades ago, of high-ranking military and intelligence officials, academic scholars, and senior-level government scientists who had convened to analyze the nature of the mysterious UFO phenomenon. This dynamic mix of professionals hailed from the Air Force, NASA, and other esteemed organizations. At the meeting, these learned and accomplished men considered that the truth about the visiting extraterrestrial is far more disturbing than we ever dare to imagine. According to the archived records of the organization, at this meeting there were 14 people in attendance. Many of the attendees were rather notable. The former Chief of Intelligence of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, two senior-level NASA scientists, a retired Air Force colonel and NASA program manager. This meeting was, in part, recorded and had included some conversations among those that were assembled that concerned what the intentions may be of these beings behind the UFO craft that were being sighted in our skies. Now, it does give a listing here of the people that were there. Frank Bloss, Robert Suggs, Leon Katchen, Frank Rawlinson, Colonel Howard Wright, and Colonel Howard McCoy. Seated among the small gathered group was retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Howard Wright. Wright served as a decorated pilot in World War II, was engaged in many military intelligence missions, and later was employed at NASA as a deputy program manager working on projects that were closely associated with the Air Force. Someone in attendance had privately recorded parts of the meeting that they think was unbeknownst to the people who were actually there and had later been stored in the NICAP archives. I wanted to play a little bit of a cutout from what was recorded. I found it to be really interesting, so let's go ahead and play that right now.
I was in intelligence for a long time, very high up in intelligence. I was in the war. It is logical thinking, not just military thinking, but it's logical thinking. There was never a successful military occupation or adventure where prior to the invasion or prior to the mass landing, there were not agents sent ahead. This is standard practice. In Germany, we and the British inserted Americans and we inserted British, who looked like the Germans and spoke their language. In Japan, we inserted them into Japan. But we had agents in their countries exactly the same as we have agents in behind the Iron Curtain. Now, the main purpose of these people is to be as exactly like the natives as possible. And yet the facts of life, the facts of military logic, the facts of cultural logic, and especially since they have not been hostile, dictate that there would be, if they are humanoid, there can be humanoids picked out, since the range of size, shape, and color on this planet covers almost the entire spectrum. It almost dictates the fact that there would be agents of these space people, wherever they come from, living among us at the present time and having been here over the last 100 years.
All right, well, sorry for the audio being a little bit off on that, but I tried to raise it up as much as I could to make it easy to hear. What I thought was really, really interesting was that he was speaking as if they were using these humanoids that could possibly be living with us on this planet, disguised more or less as us. He was talking about how they are basically using the same tactics that we used when fighting the Japanese and Germany, that we would actually take the ones that look like them and insert them into their life, you know, into their world, and, you know, more or less as a spy. So it just makes me wonder if that's, you know, is that what's going on here? Are there aliens out there that look like us? You know, they have the almond shaped eyes, the kind of bigger head, almost look like a mix between a human and a gray alien. It makes me wonder if there really are humanoid type aliens out there amongst us. I mean, is it like the show V? The old school or the new version, whichever one you wanted to go with, where they are disguised as us, or do they actually look like us so much that that's just their natural way of looking? This was taken way back in the day, you know, over 40 years ago, and that they were, you know, basically discussing aliens and extraterrestrial civilizations living here with us. I just found it to be really, really fascinating. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of pcworld.idg.com.au. The United States is building a spaceship factory in the Mojave Desert. A production facility that would build the world's first fleet of commercial spaceships is set to begin construction at the Mojave Air and Spaceport. The 6,317 square meters, or 68,000 square feet facility, one of the first aircraft assembly plants to be built in the region in decades, will be home to the Spaceship Company, or TSC, a joint venture owned by Mojave-based Scaled Composites and British billionaire Richard Branson's space tourism company Virgin Galactic. TSC hopes to complete the complex by September. It expects to build three White Knight aircraft, which resemble massive flying catamarans because each has two fuselages, and five smaller Spaceship Two rocket planes. They would be used in a way that would allow for six passengers on board. Attached to the wings of a White Knight mothership would be flown to 50,000 feet, where it would then be released. Then the rocket engine would ignite and propel the plane into suborbit. TSC expects to employ 170 people when the production is in full swing. They're actually going to start posting job openings for it. So anybody out there that needs a job and you're an engineer or a technician or something, go for it. Virgin Galactic, which says it has taken reservations and deposits from more than 380 people, hopes to make its first passenger flight next year from the yet-to-be-finished spaceport. The craft is said to climb to the edge of space about 60 miles above the Earth's surface. At the suborbital altitude, passengers experience weightlessness and see the curvature of the Earth. The price is for just a teeny little amount, man. It's only $200,000. The average person isn't ever going to be able to afford that. But anyway, I just thought it was really neat. At least we're making one step towards making space a little bit more of a tourist destination. This article is courtesy of MNN.com. It was sent to me by Rojan, and I thought it was really interesting just because of what it is. Scientists are saying that mild brain shock is stimulating math skills for up to 6 months. Stimulating the brain with a weak current of electricity can enhance a person's math skills for up to 6 months without influencing other mental functions. These results could one day help to treat the estimated 15-20% of the population who have moderate to severe numerical disabilities. It's really interesting because they're saying that what they'll do is employ a brain stimulation technique known as transcranial direct current stimulation, a non-invasive method that applies a weak current to the brain constantly over a certain period of time to enhance or reduce the activity of neurons. Over the last decade, this technique has shown the potential to help people with a variety of brain problems, such as people who have suffered from a stroke. In this research, Cohen Kadosh and his colleagues applied transcranial direct current stimulation to the parietal lobe, a brain region crucial for numerical understanding, and five university students who received the treatment possessed average abilities in math and were asked to learn a series of artificial numbers. When they received the electric stimulation over the course of 6 days, basically their math skills, for lack of a better way to put it, went through the roof. They basically were a lot better at math simply because of the placement of this electrical current. I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, the brain works on electrical signals anyway, and to increase that through electrical stimulation is just really fascinating to me. It makes me look at the human body a little bit differently and think that we are way more complex than we'll ever understand. We might understand a little bit more and more every day, but will we ever actually understand all of the human brain and what its potential is if it was running at a full 100%? Anyway, I just thought it was really, really interesting. Now, yesterday, right at the end of the night, right before I about shut the computer off, I got a video. A guy has videotaped a UFO in the sky and an alien on the ground. Now, this guy is watching this UFO. He seems a bit freaked out about what he's seeing. As the UFO kind of hovers above this little bit of a hill or a small little mountain, it eventually takes off. He loses sight of it. Now, this is probably, say, 5 minutes, 10 minutes before complete darkness, before the sun is completely down. You can see a little bit of light off in the distance to where you know the sun has just set. This UFO is kind of going back and forth, and then it takes off. Well, the guy takes his camera and shines it down a little country dirt road. Now, on this country dirt road, there's a little barn off to the right and a field off to the left. The dirt road goes down the middle in between the two. The red light comes on, so everything turns green. Well, as he's filming, you can see what appears to be a bipedal creature that's maybe 3 feet tall that appears to be an alien. When he notices it and starts going a little bit towards it, it jumps off like probably 20 feet in the air and about 40 feet away. It's really, really interesting. I'm watching it right now, and it jumps like a kangaroo, but like 5 to 10 times further than what a kangaroo would jump. It's really, really wild. Now, if this is fake, I don't know what to make of it, because whoever did it did a really good job of blending everything in. If it's animated, then, you know, it wouldn't surprise me because of the way technology is these days. But it was just a really, really interesting video, because it kind of correlates that there was an alien on the ground. Maybe it had just been dropped off by his friends. I don't know, but there was a UFO above, and then he sees the aliens. So there's got to be some correlation there between the two. But I just found it to be really interesting. I want you guys to go watch this video. And thank you, Manuel, for sending this in. I really do appreciate it. It's a really, really bizarre video. If it is real, I don't know if I've ever seen or heard of an alien being witnessed, whether it's on film or not, that jumped away the way that this one jumped away. I've never seen one or even heard of an account of an alien moving in this fashion. You know, I've heard of them hovering. I've heard of them, you know, just disappearing. I've heard of them, you know, just walking away. I've seen video of them just standing there, but I've never seen one jump like this. I thought it to be really interesting, and I want you guys to go take a look at it. Now, the next article I want to take a look at is courtesy of CBC.ca, and I just thought it was really funny because of the controversy over it. I used to hunt a lot whenever I was growing up, and I love it. It's a lot of fun. I don't mind, I'll say this right now, and hopefully this doesn't offend anybody, but I don't mind hunting at all, because when I kill an animal, it's being used. It's going to be eaten. It's going to be, you know, there's not anything that's really ever going to go to waste. So I don't feel bad for that. You know, it's just part of life. The life involves death. And I have a deer that's taxidermied and is, you know, mounted up and hanging on a wall. You know, I have it, you know, I don't mind. It doesn't bother me at all. But apparently a humane society is having an issue with a piggy bank that is made from a real piglet. The Winnipeg Humane Society is calling for a protest over an item in a holiday gift guide, a piggy bank made out of a real piglet stuffed and mounted. Aileen White, spokesman for the Winnipeg Humane Society, says she is disgusted with the people behind the item. It's such an incredible, in-your-face trivialization of what was once a living being. It just demonstrates such callousness and insensitivity. The bank with a $4,000 price tag is described on the cheeky.com as the piggy bank of all piggy banks. Well, it is a piggy bank because it is a real pig. But the website states that the bank is designed for anyone who has far too much money and loose change. I thought it was really interesting. You know, I mean, it doesn't really bother me at all. I just find it funny what people will spend their time getting mad over. I just thought it's just really interesting, really funny. And it has a picture here of the piggy bank. It looks like a little piglet with a slit in its back. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of SingularityHub.com. A company has come up with a retina implant that restores vision to the blind, and for some of them, lets them see in infrared. Scientists in Germany have developed a retina implant to restore vision to the blind. The device, developed by Retina Implant AG, is an array of 1,500 plus photodiodes, roughly 38 by 40 pixels, that is surgically placed under the retina. Light that enters the eye stimulates the photodiodes, which send electric currents through the underlying neurons. In a recent article in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, researchers describe how blind patients, mostly suffering from retinitis pigmentosa, were able to see light in dark areas and discern basic shapes only a week after their surgeries. One man was even able to see differences between objects and read large letters. As remarkable as that would be, implant patients also report a sensitivity to infrared light. The retina implant could only provide very basic vision, but it did so in an extended spectrum. Cybernetic implants like these may not only be able to restore sight to the blind, but they could let them see things that no normal person has ever seen before with their own eyes. The Proceedings of the Royal Society B article that was recently published is based off of 3 patients from an 11-patient group. Of those 11, at least 5 saw improvements in vision, 2 saw greatly improved sensitivity to light and shapes, and 1 man could actually distinguish between forks and apples on a table and even read, and he even pointed out when the doctors misspelled his name. The lead author on the recent publication on Retina Implant AG's device is already working with a new set of patients using an improved version of the implant. These 25 people will have implants that receive power from a source located behind the ear instead of a pack worn around the neck. In the future, these devices will become streamlined with higher resolution and a greater field of vision. There's quite a bit more to that article there that you guys can go and read. There's also a couple of pictures there of the people that were, you know, that they did these implants on. What I thought to be really interesting about this and why I wanted to put it into the show, if they're able to see into the infrared spectrum, they're actually able to see infrared light. Would that mean that they're able to see ghosts? Because I've seen on a lot of TV shows, a lot of pictures online, a lot of videos online, a lot of articles that I've read online, that you can see ghosts in the infrared. I'm wondering if they're going to be able to see those kinds of things, or will it still be your mind would have to raise that wall that it has put up against these things so you don't see them? Will this help for them to see them? Will it drive them crazy? I want to see what happens with this later on down the road and see if any of them actually have the implants removed. If you guys have any opinions on any of this stuff, let me know. I would love to hear what you have to say. Let's go ahead and take a little bit of a break here. And when we come back, we have got a lot of really, really good stuff to take a look at. We're going to be looking at the Burroughs Cave Enigma, the Pedro Mountains Mummy, an execution online as an artist let users decide his fate. That and a whole lot more, so you guys stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is Lex, the host of the Anything Goes show, and you and I are listening to the 13 Skulls podcast. Enjoy.
My name is X246ZY7 from the planet Dotopia. And when I'm in your rather primitive solar system, I go to paranormalpodcast.com and set my podcast aggregator to Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold. Finally, a show about me.
Well, sort of. At Paranormal Podcast, we interview authors and experts from around the world about everything from UFOs and ghosts to the existence of life after death. Are crop circles real? Is there scientific explanations for the Bermuda Triangle phenomena? Learn this and so much more on the Paranormal Podcast. Now, we take our subject matter seriously, but we have fun too. Even skeptics are welcome. So please subscribe. It's free. You can find us at Podcast Alley, the iTunes Music Store, or at ParanormalPodcast.com. Take a listen. Open your mind.
Midnight Corey.
It's a knife in your eye.
Midnight Corey.
It's a fistful of glass.
Midnight Corey.
It will make you regret the day you were born.
Midnight Corey. It's a hammer to the face.
Midnight Corey.
It's the nightmare that never ends.
Midnight Corey.
It's time to die.
Midnight Corey.
It's slippery with intestines.
Midnight Corey.
It's the smell of burning flesh.
Join us at MidnightCorey.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Now let's go ahead and take a look at an article that's courtesy of BibliotecaPleiades.net, and it's the Burroughs Cave Enigma. And in Illinois, there's a cave called Burroughs Cave. In 1982, a large quantity of epigraphic material was found there by its discoverer, a gentleman by the name of Russell Burroughs. What is claimed by Burroughs certainly doesn't seem to be readily digestible by mainstream archaeologists. In Russell Burroughs' own words, this is an account of how he described the cave having stopped to eat his lunch on a bluff that overlooks a valley. He stood up and stepped on the edge of a flat, round rock and fell into a pit below. He says, quote, "I found myself falling into a pit which had been secreted beneath a large oval stone which, as I later discovered, was fitted into the pit opening and designed to flip or turn over when stepped on. The unfortunate victim would fall to the bottom of the pit, the stone would swing back into place, and the victim would be trapped. I was fortunate. When I stepped on that stone, I was in the act of turning, and on the stone, instead of flipping over, slid off to one side and left the pit open. I do not actually remember hitting the bottom. My next recollection is of hanging on to the lip of the pit by my elbows. In great alarm, I admit that I had a great fear of holes. I wasn't ready for it. When I freed myself and regained my composure, I began to examine the pit and have a look at what was the beginning of the greatest adventure of my life. I sat down to calm my nerves, catch my breath, and give the situation some thought. He found himself in a chamber with a large face on one wall. I did not have to be a genius to figure out that I had stumbled into something that just should not be in Illinois. I have hunted for and found many artifacts of the American Indians, and that there are many of their sites in that part of the state, but I knew that this was not American Indian. The face I had been nose to nose with was different from anything that I had ever seen. The nose was flat, the eyes were wide set, and the lips were thick. Then, of course, there were all those strange symbols to consider. I had crawled under a ledge and was looking for petroglyphs such as I had seen in the pit. I had searched all of the walls of the entire length of the valley, and while I had seen a few scratchings, I was not at all excited about what I had seen so far. Finally, I gave up on this last place and decided to quit. In disgust, I tossed my small rock pick against the wall on the overhang. The rock gave out a distinctly unnatural sound, a hollow ring, not what I expected from solid rock. As it was now clear that a cave was on the other side, my first entrance was through this portal and into a tunnel-like passage, which was a drop-off about 3 feet just inside the portal. I was met with a strong, musty odor, not of decay, but musty. As I moved my head and light around, I saw a full human skeleton reposing on a large block of stone. It scared the hell out of me. Then I began to see other things lying around with those bones. I saw axe heads, spear points, and something else. Metal. The skeleton was laid out upon a solid block large enough to hold not only the remains but all the artifacts as well. The artifacts include axe heads made of marble and other stone material, an axe head of what appears to be bronze, a short sword of what appears to be bronze, and other artifacts which might be considered personal weapons. There were also a set of 3 bronze spears, the longest being about 6 feet long and the shortest about 3 feet. The skeletal remains bear several fine artifacts such as armbands, headbands, and other gold items. The cave is said to lie somewhere along the Skillet Fork of the Little Wabash River in southeastern Illinois. It supposedly contains about 13 elaborately ornated burial crypts. It is unclear, and a matter of controversy, who, besides Burroughs, actually had been inside the cave. What is known is that Burroughs had produced hundreds, if not thousands, of curiously carved stones that he says come from this cave. And some of the artifacts allegedly were not stone, but made of gold. And Burroughs had apparently sold enough of this gold material, these gold artifacts, to be able to put $7 million away in Swiss bank accounts. It's really interesting. There's quite a bit of pictures and stuff there of where he had gone through this cave, and supposedly pictures of gold artifacts from the cave showing Egyptian hieroglyphs on them. I just thought it to be really, really interesting, and it goes together with this next article that I wanted to take a look at, which is courtesy of crystallinks.com. And apparently, ancient were also not just in Illinois, but in Australia as well. About 5,000 years ago, Australia's amazing hieroglyphs still struggle for recognition. Now, if you go, there's a little bit to this article here, quite a bit more than I want to read, but quite a lot of really interesting pictures of what appear to be ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs in Australia. There's quite a bit there to it. I want you guys to go take a look at them and let me know what you think. There are over 250 hieroglyphs that are apparently in there that were carved into a rock cliff. And it's just really, really interesting to know that these are there. Now, does that mean that ancient Egyptians went way further around the world than what anyone has ever given them credit for? I mean, it does speak volumes for how advanced the Egyptian civilization really, really was. If they had made it all the way to Illinois and all the way to Australia, to be able to sail that far is just absolutely amazing. I want you guys to go take a look at it and let me know what you think. This next website that I wanted to take a look at, it's not even an article, it's just a website, I found to be really, really curious. It's jessicaharrison.co.uk. Basically, this woman is making porcelain figurines, but they're not just any normal porcelain figurines. These are zombie porcelain figurines. This one that I'm looking at right now is what would appear to be a very well put together woman in a white dress with nice shoes, but her head is upside down on her lap and she is, you know, there's blood everywhere. It's just really, really interesting. One of them is a zombie woman, her hands all decayed, and it's just really, really cool. I want you guys to go take a look at this stuff. I just found it to be really interesting because zombies are making such a big statement now. You know, there's a lot of it in today's media. She makes a lot of really crazy, weird porcelain figurines and a lot of really odd, I don't even know what some of this stuff is, but these porcelain zombie figurines are really, really cool. Just go to page 3 of jessicaharrison.co.uk and you'll see what I'm talking about. They're just really fascinating and I found it to be really interesting that they're making these figurines that are of zombies. I just found it to be really cool. Now, this next article is courtesy of newsweird.com. For those of you who dream, this might actually tell you how intelligent you really are, because apparently smart people dream in HD color and us regular folks, well, we dream in black and white. A new claim reveals the higher the intellectual development of a person, the more they dream. Studied in detail the nature of sleep, scientists have concluded that dreams in which a person sees in color are people who are more developed mentally. Smart people dream in HD color and regular people black and white, and or they just can't remember their dreams at all. In tests attended by 2,000 people, they were asked if they see dreams. But as it turned out, the majority of respondents' dreams do not dream or they just don't remember them at all. Only a small group of participants regularly have vivid dreams. These people were asked to pass predictive testing and they all managed to excellently. Scientists have concluded that the more mentally developed the person is, the more detailed or brighter they are dreaming. During the night's rest, the brain does not cease to be active and analyzes the events of the day. In people with reduced mental capacity, the brain is less active, so basically it doesn't function while you sleep. Now, for me, I just can't remember them all that well sometimes, but anyway, I just thought it was really interesting that basically if you're not very smart, you're just going to dream in black and white. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Examiner.com. I know a lot of you don't like Examiner, but still it was really interesting. A California witness, according to MUFON, saw it on November 3rd at 3:30 a.m. on Highway 101 while they were driving north. They saw a triangle-shaped craft hovering silently 300 feet off the ground. After just a couple of minutes, the object slowly rotated clockwise, climbed, and made a gradual right turn, and then became smaller and smaller until it was out of sight. It had lights on each corner that dimmed in the middle to a light orange color. This is MUFON case 26374. Person says that they were driving to Santa Barbara from their house in Santa Maria. They went across the San Marcos Pass and the Michael Jackson Neverland Ranch, hit a stretch of highway where it was pitch black and was, basically they saw this thing hovering in the sky just a couple hundred yards off the ground. It was just really interesting. I thought it'd be funny that we're seeing a lot of triangle-shaped UFOs. And in the last episode, we were talking about TR-3B, and it makes me wonder if maybe that was what they saw. But let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of universetoday.com. And apparently the Milky Way is missing dark matter. The study concentrated on detecting the dark matter by studying the luminous matter embedded in it in much the same way dark matter was originally discovered. By studying the kinetics of the matter, it allowed the astronomers to determine the overall mass present that would dictate the movement. The observed mass could then be compared to the amount of mass predicted by both baryonic matter as well as the dark matter component. The team, led by C. Moni Bidden, used 300 red giant stars in the Milky Way's thick disk to map the mass distribution of the region. To eliminate any contamination from the thin disk component, the team limited their selections to stars over 2 kiloparsecs from the galactic midplane, and velocities characteristic of such stars to avoid contamination from halo stars. Once they were selected, the team analyzed the overall velocity of the stars as a function of distance from the galactic center, which would give an understanding of the mass interior to their orbits. Using estimations on the mass from the visible stars in the interstellar medium, the team compared the visible mass to the solution for mass from the observations of the kinematics to search for a discrepancy indicative of dark matter. When the comparison was made, the team discovered that the agreement between the visible mass and our dynamical solution is striking, and there is no need to invoke any dark component. While this finding doesn't rule out the presence of dark matter, it does place constraints on its distribution, and if confirmed in other galaxies, may challenge the understanding of how dark matter serves to form galaxies. Basically, they looked at our galaxy, they used the techniques that they normally use, and more or less there isn't what they thought there would be as far as dark matter in our galaxy. So anyway, I just thought it was really interesting. I know that might have been over a few people's heads there. It was slightly over mine, but I find it to be interesting anyway. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Wikipedia and courtesy of subversiveelement.com. Now, what we're going to be taking a look at here is called the Pedro Mountains Mummy. In October 1932, while digging for gold in the San Pedro Mountains, two prospectors, Cecil Main and Frank Carr, blasted their way through some thick rock that a large vein of gold continued into. When the dust settled, they saw they had opened up a small room, approximately 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and about 15 inches deep. This is where they first saw the mummy of a tiny person. Pedro the mummy was found sitting in an upright position with his arms crossed, covering its crossed legs. It sat perpendicular to the floor on a small ledge in the room. It weighed approximately 12 ounces and was around 7 inches tall sitting, and around 14 inches tall standing. Its cranium was flattened, the eyes bulging, and so well preserved that even the fingernails were visible. The head was covered in a dark, gelatinous substance, leading some to accuse Main and Carr of perpetrating a hoax using an infant from a medical collection, since some of the mummies appeared to have been preserved in liquid. Upon its discovery, it was instantly called a hoax. In 1950, the mummy was examined by Dr. Henry Shapiro, a biological anthropologist from the American Museum of Natural History. After examining the x-rays, Dr. Shapiro believed that this mummy was the body of an approximately 65-year-old man at the time of his death. Also, this mummy had particularly large canines in comparison with the rest of his body size, almost vampire-like. These findings were substantiated by Harvard University in their anthropology department. Later, Dr. George Gill, a forensic anthropologist, proposed another theory after looking at the x-rays. He thought that the body could have been an infant of some unknown tribe of Indians. A second similar mummy was found in roughly the same area and brought to the attention of Dr. Gill after he appeared on a television show called Unsolved Mysteries. After the discovery of the second, this time a female mummy, he could x-ray her and look at her in great detail. She was only 4 inches tall and in a slumped position. Dr. Gill determined that she was an infant and hypothesized that she was either a prematurely born baby or possibly a child with anencephaly. After testing, the family that owned the girl mummy took her back and was never heard from again. Now, there's a little bit more here to it. There's quite a bit of other articles here that you can go and take a look at. I just thought it was really interesting that they found it. Now, I've never heard of a 65-year-old, 7 or 14-inch tall person. I mean, 14 inches, that's really not all that long. Just take a regular 1-foot ruler and add 2 inches to it, and there you go. I mean, it was just really, really interesting. I mean, maybe it was just a case of a little person that was just unbelievably little. But what you'll see with the subversiveelement.com website article on the Pedro Mountains mummy is an actual picture of the Pedro Mountains mummy. If it is a human being, it's a rather odd-looking human being. Part of me almost thinks that maybe it was a monkey of some kind. I don't know. I want you guys to go take a look at this and let me know what you think about the picture and the story of the Pedro's Mountain Mummy. I just found it really interesting that this was hidden in a mountain somewhere. I mean, who would have put it there? I mean, would it have just been like a little crypt for an infant of some kind that somebody was just mourning the loss of their baby? But to have it sitting there with its legs crossed, with its arms folded over its legs, I just found it to be really interesting. I want you guys to go take a look at it and let me know what you think. Now, the next article that I want to take a look at is courtesy of thetruthbehindthescenes.wordpress.com, and it's a couple of pictures of what appears to be a very odd-looking UFO. Just after sunset, while sitting on the deck on November 6th in Lake Bennett, Australia, they didn't use the flash. They were trying to take pictures of the sunset and, I guess, a daughter fishing. They took the picture, and basically what they got, you'll see a lake in front of you with some trees off in the horizon, a few clouds in the skies. There's a girl fishing with a fishing pole in her hand on what appears to be a dock. You'll have some railing and stuff there, you know, on the side of the dock. And off in the distance, you'll see this bright, oddly shaped object that has a trail behind it. This object came from behind clouds because this trail stops as soon as it meets the edge of the clouds. This object looks like a bean, like a kidney bean, but with a couple of arms sticking out on the sides of it. So it kind of looks like, I don't know, like a bee of some kind. I don't know, but it's really, really bright. So my guess is I'm wondering if maybe what they got was a piece of space debris, you know, that circles the Earth coming in and burning up. Was it maybe just, a meteorite of some kind that this person just so happened to take a picture at the exact right moment for it to come out like this? I don't know what to think of this. I know it's a UFO because it's unexplained. It obviously is flying because it's in the sky and it's an object of some kind. So I don't really know what to make of it. I just thought it to be really interesting. I want you guys to take a look at the picture and let me know what you think of this flying UFO that was spotted in Australia.
I am death.
The stars have secrets. Some say these secrets have fallen from the skies. The government says it's not true. But in the 40s, they created an organization to track down flyers, to learn their technology, and bring one back. The threat of peace leads Black Ridge Defense to investigate rumors of a secret organization named Division 10. Typhon system-wide has pushed ahead of its rivals to be the first in orbit and the first to mine the asteroid belt. But when they learn of Black Ridge's investigation, they form an alliance to take control of Division 10, and they're going to take down a president to do it. As their plans come to a head, something emerges from a burning building in New York City. Something that could threaten Typhon and Black Ridge victory. Their soldiers are on the way, and so are the black helicopters of Division 10. But there's another player in this game, and far higher stakes than control of a government or new technology. The Flyers are back.
Enemy Lines, a novel written and performed by John Miro. For more information, visit enemylinesnovel.com.
So, you thought that Hall of Mirrors Volume 1 was the end of the hall, did you? Well, think again, listener. Hall of Mirrors Volume 2. A further 6 tales of horror, the grotesque, and people in unusual circumstances. In Salvation, Jeffrey Leach makes a pact with Satan. But when the time to make good on the deal arrives, will Jeffrey be able to give the devil his due? In Give Me 100, small-time crook Benny is late for a hold-up. However, bad timekeeping is just the start of his problems. In The Green Man, Alec and Libby find there are darker things in the woods than Alec's not-so-lovely picnic spot. In Dessert, a man takes his dog for a walk and neglects to bring a little baggie for its poop. Nightmarish? Oh yes. In The Exterminators, we journey to New York to discover a new and extremely cunning species of predatory cockroach. And finally, in Night Crossing, we meet Lord Underwood and his trusty sidekick, Flinch, in the short story prequel to the novel Underwood and Flinch. And a most bloody introduction it is, too. Hall of Mirrors, Volume 2 by Mike Bennett. Tales of murder, horror, pest infestation, and dog poo baggy dilemmas. Available for download now at podiobooks.com.
Throughout the Planetary Union fleet, there are rumors about a secret ship named the PUV James Keeling, a ship no one has seen or can even describe. They say the crew on this ship has an 80% mortality rate, but not all deaths are from combat. That's why when people talk of this ship in hushed whispers, they don't call it the Keeling. They call it the Crypt, because it's filled with the dead. If you've been convicted of cowardice in battle, theft, assault, rape, even murder, sometimes you get a choice: execution or serve a 2-year stint on the Keeling. The smart ones, they choose execution. They say that in space, no one can hear you scream, but inside a ship, they can hear you just fine. The Crypt is a free audio novel by New York Times bestselling author Scott Sigler, creator of Infected, Contagious, and Ancestor. Download it at podiobooks.com.
I am Death.
Now, this next article is courtesy of guardian.co.uk, and it's just something quick that I wanted to read through because I thought it was really interesting, and it kind of goes to show you where society is heading at this point. Apparently, now you can diagnose your own STDs using your phone. That's right, your cell phone. Mobile phones and computers will soon be able to diagnose sexually transmitted diseases under innovative plans to cut the UK's rising rate of herpes, chlamydia, and gonorrhea among young people. Doctors and technology experts are developing small devices similar to pregnancy testing kits that will tell someone quickly and privately if they have caught an infection through sexual contact. People who suspect they have been infected will be able to put urine or saliva onto a computer chip about the size of a USB chip, plug it into their phone or computer, and receive a diagnosis within minutes telling them which, if any, sexually transmitted infection they have. The self-testing devices are aimed at technology-savvy young people. Public health experts are concerned that although most STDs or STIs occur among that age group, many are too embarrassed to visit a general practitioner, genitourinary medicine clinic to get tested and therefore continue to suffer and potentially pass the disease on. Doctors hope that the ability to obtain a private, confidential diagnosis will overcome their widespread reluctance to take a test. The developers of the rapid testing devices expect them to be sold for about £1 or €1 in vending machines in nightclubs, pharmacies, and in supermarkets, the same as condoms are. They are drawing on nanotechnology and microfluidics, the creation of miniaturized laboratories. There's quite a bit more to this article there. I just thought it was really interesting that now you're able to diagnose yourself with your cell phone. Now, maybe there's some real good credence to this, that you'll be able to do this and it'll be accurate, but I'm wondering what the overall accuracy rate of these will be to tell you exactly what you have. Now, I know that if it is using some kind of a micro laboratory, you know, that's using nanotechnology and microfluidics to tell exactly what you have, maybe there is something to it that you can actually trust it. I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting. I want you guys to go and finish reading this article. And if anybody knows or has even used one of these, please let me know if it actually works. We'll keep it private. That way nobody will know who you are. But I'd love, hey, Miles, you're over there. Miles, go check it out. Let me know what these if these things work or not. I want to know if this is going to work, because this is really telling me where, you know, people are becoming less social. They're not, I mean, yeah, people don't want to go to the doctor anyway, but they're becoming a little bit less social. I just thought it to be really, really interesting. So anyway, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of beforeitsnews.com. And it's just a video for you guys to go watch. And apparently a Russian artist has strapped himself into an electric chair and asked online viewers to vote on his fate. Oleg Mavromati, who lives in self-imposed exile in Bulgaria, is known for his controversial public stunts. And this time he says his electrocution experiment is meant to highlight censorship issues in Russia. You may find some images in this story disturbing. It is quite funny, actually. I want you guys to go and take a look at this video. It's really quite interesting that he's doing this because he wants to make a point about society. I don't know, it's just really, really interesting. I want you guys to go and look at the guy who's letting people online basically electrocute him in his own home. I just found it to be really, really weird. All right, well, you know what, guys? It's, you know, we've been on here for a little bit longer. We've still got a lot of stuff to go. But let's go ahead and take a little bit of a break here. And, you know, whenever we get back, we've got a lot of really good stuff. We're going to be taking a look at the Great Blue Hole. Al-Qaeda had a plot to put bombs in dogs. Just thought it was really, really interesting. And scientists have discovered how to turn human skin into blood. All right, well, when we get back, we'll look at all that stuff and more. So you guys stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. We are your children, so far from what you thought you meant. The next article that I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of AOLnews.com. You can go and eat inside of a giant gingerbread house. I know the holiday season's coming around, and you know, people like to build their gingerbread houses, and you can actually go dine inside of one. The Great Wolf Lodge in Niagara Falls, Canada is preparing its third annual giant gingerbread house, complete with more than 600 pounds of gingerbread, 1,000 pounds of icing, 2,000 chocolate wafers, 750 cookies, and 4,900 pretzels. Construction of its two-story high wooden frame began on Monday, and today a culinary team will begin applying confections to the life-size candy cottage. The three full-time bakers and executive chef will be dedicated to the project for the next 2 weeks. In previous years, the gingerbread house has been a favorite feature of the Great Wolf Lodge. You can smell it when you walk into the building, General Manager Keith Simmons said. You can smell the gingerbread and the chocolate. Once the house is finished in early December, it will accept reservations for one table of six. a family of six can go eat inside this gingerbread house. I just thought it was really interesting. You can order everything off of the menu that's in the lodge, including breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And, it's just really, really interesting what people do. I just found it to be really funny. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of DatelineZero.com. And it's a UFO crash drill in UK schools. There seems to be a growing trend among schools to stage a UFO crash and then teach students how to react, as well as to how to properly investigate and report on the incident. It sounds like a lot of fun and a great way to fire up a student's imagination as well as writing skills. The latest UFO drill took place on Wednesday, September 29th at Sanford Primary School in the UK. The kids were treated to a full UFO crash scenario that included wreckage, police tape, and real police officers. Police were on hand to show the children how to properly investigate the UFO site crash. I just thought it was really, really interesting that they're doing this. I know this article is kind of old. It was from back in the 10th of October. I just thought it was really interesting. I wanted to put it into the show, and I never did back in earlier shows. So I thought it was neat that they're doing UFO crash drills in the UK. If anybody over there in the UK, Miles S., anybody over there that's listening, have you heard anything about this? I'd love to know. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on. We've got a lot of stuff to cover, and we're already getting close to an hour or over an hour just now. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Guardian.co.uk. Stone Age etchings have been found in the Amazon when the river levels fell. They have revealed engravings that have been up to 7,000 years old. A series of ancient underwater etchings have been uncovered near the jungle city of Manaus, M-A-N-A-U-S, following a drought in the Brazilian Amazon. The previously submerged images, engraved on rocks and possibly up to 7,000 years old, were reportedly discovered by a fisherman after the Rio Negro, a tributary of the Amazon River, fell to its lowest level in more than 100 years last month. Archaeologists who have studied the photographs believe the art, which features images of faces and snakes, is another indication that thousands of years ago the Amazon was already home to large civilizations. Eduardo Neves, president of the Brazilian Society of Archaeology and a lead Amazon scholar, said the etchings appear to have been made between 3,000 and 7,000 years ago when the water levels in the region were lower. The etchings were further undeniable evidence that the region had been occupied by a significant number of ancient settlements and people. Recent years have seen a growing number of archaeologists studying the Amazon, revising previous theories that the rainforest was too inhospitable to host a major civilization. Which is really interesting to me that they're finding these things. I always find it really, really fascinating when new things are unearthed, things that we didn't know about, things that involve civilizations that we had no clue existed. It really makes me wonder how much of our history we truly know. How much of our history as humans are we unaware of at this point? To know that the Amazon is so huge and so under-searched, they don't really know much about it, constantly learning new things about the Amazon, and I really look forward to seeing what else they're able to uncover. If they can figure out exactly who it was, what peoples it was that came up with these carvings, I just found it to be really interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of news.discovery.com. Paleontologists have found the oldest dinosaur embryo ever found. They have identified the world's oldest known dinosaur embryos, according to a paper in the current Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. The embryos, found in their still well-preserved eggs, date to the early Jurassic period 190 million years ago. The researchers say they have found the oldest known embryos for any land-dwelling vertebrate. They belong to the Massospondylus, a member of a group of dinosaurs called prosauropods that were ancestors to the giant plant-eating sauropods. Sauropods are the iconic four-legged dinosaurs known for their long necks and long tails. Professor Robert Rees of the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and his colleagues made the discovery while analyzing the fossilized eggs originally found in South Africa. The embryos are so remarkably well-preserved, they permitted a complete reconstruction of the skeleton and a detailed interpretation of the anatomy. The embryos were close to hatching, revealing their ossification, or how much of their skeleton had turned to bone. The fossils also show that the future hatchlings would have been oddly proportioned and would have looked very different from the adult species, according to the researchers. To some extent, these dinosaurs then developed as humans do today. The infancy is awkward, as researchers put it, and more erect stance and evenly proportioned bodies only come later. Additionally, the embryos lacked teeth. With the awkward body proportions, it is then likely that the hatchlings would have required parental care. If that's the case, these fossils also document the oldest record of parental care, according to the paleontologist. I just thought it was really interesting. It just goes to show you that just because we think of dinosaurs as being these mean, terrifying creatures, they actually were caring and loved their offspring enough to take care of them until they were able to be able to fend for themselves. I just found it to be really interesting. I love archaeology, and to know that they're finding things like this is just, it's just really fascinating. I love it. You know, to know that something that is 190 million years old survived until the year 2010 to today, it's fascinating that anything can survive for that long. Now let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Cryptomundo.com, and it's something that I hadn't ever heard of before, called the rock ape, which is something that that was seen by Vietnam soldiers during the Vietnam War, whatever you want to call it. I don't want to go there, so let's just go on into it. There's a book called Very Crazy GI, Strange But True Stories of the Vietnam War, where veteran Craig P.J. Jorgensen tells of how he had an actual sighting of a short, red-haired, hairy, upright anthropoid, which he says soldiers in Vietnam called a rock ape. One even said to have captured in Dak Lak province in 1971, and in 1974, a North Vietnamese general, Hoang Minh Thao, requested an expedition to find evidence of the creatures, but they were unsuccessful. Other soldiers were told down through the years, they have told their own stories of seeing these cryptids. Quote, all except one was light brown to reddish brown in color and about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. One dark, almost black male remained fighting to protect the others' retreat, and he was flying through the branches and rushing the men with his teeth bared. Now, some people are saying that this possibly could be a gibbon that he was seeing, that they actually didn't see any type of cryptid, that it was actually just a monkey, a gibbon that people were actually seeing. But if you wanted to read more about these, again, the book that this is all coming from is called Very Crazy GI, Strange But True Stories of the Vietnam War. I just thought it to be really interesting. There's a couple of different posts here that I will put up for you guys to go read. One of them is an actual account of veteran Jorgensen's account of actually seeing what they are calling a rock ape in Vietnam. Now, this next article that I wanted to take a look at actually really isn't an article. It's courtesy of paranormal.about.com. It's supposedly a picture of a backyard phantom. The picture was taken on December 6th of 2009 by a person named Patrick. They say that you can basically see that there is what appears to be a face and a body of someone in a picture that should not be there. They said that they were taking a picture in their backyard, and if you zoom in on the face, it makes it even weirder. Basically, what you'll see is a backyard that's covered in snow with a tree and a little shed out in the back, and up against the tree line, or what it would be a fence line in this grainy, grainy picture, is what appears to be a face just hovering there with what could potentially be an arm coming down on the right, an arm coming down on the left, with a black body just standing there. It is rather creepy. I wanted you guys to go take a look at it and let me know what you think about the backyard phantom photo. It really is quite creepy, and it does appear to be a face. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of zombieresearch.net. And if you guys, if any of you are good writers and you love zombies and you love to write, then this article is for you. Basically, the Zombie Research Society is in the early stages of launching an online zombie magazine that will be definitive web stop for all things undead. The Zombie Research Society, or ZRS, is looking for established bloggers to join their growing team of zombie experts committed to regularly contributing to the cause. This is a completely volunteer gig, as the site will be free to users and won't even include paid advertising. It's not about the money, but rather about helping to continue the wave of positive zombie expressions in entertainment and academic circles. If you're a passionate writer-blogger with a substantial online portfolio of work, you can contact Andrew Morrison at amorrison@zombieresearch.org, and they'll give you more information on it. If you're a writer and you really want to get into it, maybe that's for you. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of smh.com.au, and apparently you really can be scared to death. It turns out that yes, a good enough scare can be the cause of your demise, but probably not if you're in normal health. If it were to happen to someone with a precondition, a weak heart, or an aneurysm in the brain, says Brian Hurlbut, who teaches psychology at Southern Connecticut State University, when you're scared, or scared badly, a part of the nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, prepares your body for violent activity. There have been causes in which criminals have been charged with murder or manslaughter because their victims died from heart attacks. But, of course, the death certificate isn't likely to reflect that, and the person will go to jail for manslaughter. When there's a sudden threat of danger, your system dumps adrenaline into your bloodstream so that it goes to your muscles. At the same time, blood vessels in the skin and digestive system constrict so that blood will be directed to your muscles, which is why people don't get hungry whenever they're nervous or scared. Once the threat is diminished, the part of the body known as the parasympathetic nervous system brings everything back into normal condition. People do die of overexertion, but usually they do have pre-existing conditions that no one knew about, such as maybe a heart murmur or something like that, where if they all of a sudden have a sudden shock of adrenaline, it makes their heart stop. But anyway, I just thought it was really interesting that you truly can be scared to death. The next article is courtesy of myfoxnewyork.com. Al-Qaeda was planning on sowing bombs inside of dogs. Al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq tried to unleash deadly terror in the skies by deploying a pair of dogs on a U.S.-bound plane that had bombs in them. The plot failed because the bombs were so badly stitched inside the dogs that they died, according to the report in the respected French daily newspaper Le Figaro. This case illustrates the determination of Al-Qaeda militants who are trying to circumvent terrorism controls by any means, according to French criminologist Christophe Naudin, who is an aviation expert. The plot unfolded 2 years ago when Al-Qaeda bomb makers grabbed the two stray dogs off the street and surgically implanted powerful explosives and detonators in each. It's not unusual for dogs to fly from Iraq to the U.S. Several animal rescue groups work to give Iraqi dogs new U.S. homes, and soldiers have also adopted dogs from there. But before the dogs were put aboard the planes, U.S. soldiers working in the airport cargo area noticed they had died and soon discovered the bombs stitched inside. U.S. intelligence agencies shared the story of the dog's fate with other Western spy agencies and distributed necropsy photos of the dogs and bombs to aviation security professionals. You know, I'm a dog lover myself, and it kind of makes me sick to think that they would actually do this to a dog, but given what they'll do to people, it doesn't surprise me one single bit. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Wired.com. Robots have identified human flesh as tasting like bacon. It says, "Let the robot holocaust commence." This is for you, Shannon, for more robot domination. Researchers at NEC System Technologies and MIE University have designed the cute little guy to the right, which is a picture of a little, small, little, teen, little robot. He's a cute little guy. A metal gastronomist, an electromechanical sommelier, capable of identifying wines, cheeses, meats, and hors d'oeuvres. Upon being given a sample, he will speak up in a childlike voice and identify what he has just been fed. The idea is that wineries can tell if a wine is authentic without even opening the bottle. Amongst other obscure uses, like tell me what is this strange grayish lump in the back of my freezer is or was, but some smart aleck reporter placed his hand in the robot's omnivorous clanking jaw, and he was identified as tasting like bacon. Anyway, it's kind of funny that basically the guy tasted like bacon. I don't really understand why, but I thought it was really funny that this little robot can identify flavors. It's really quite interesting. The next article, which is courtesy of 9news.com, and a UFO commission sadly will not be created in Denver. The measure to create a commission to deal with credible reports of extraterrestrial activity in Denver has failed. Denver Initiative 300, also known as the ET Commission, failed with less than 1% of the precinct's reporting, 84-16. Supporters of the ET Commission said it wouldn't cost taxpayers any money and would be funded through grants, gifts, and donations. The commission would have been charged with dealing with credible UFO reports, listening to and documenting reports of extraterrestrial encounters and abductions. It doesn't bode well for any other states having one if they're not going to have one there. Maybe there's some other states out there that are a little bit more open to having something like this, but you know, whatever, I guess that Denver just doesn't want to have that. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of Examiner.com again. And apparently 70-80% of Americans believe in paranormal activity. Surveys have always been skewed because the researchers started with groups of people they know are already interested in at least one area, such as ghosts or UFOs. According to Bader and Minkin, more people believe in the existence of UFOs than any other type of paranormal activity, and of that group, more males than females are believers. However, in all other areas, women outnumber men in their beliefs. The survey asked questions about educational levels, income levels, religious affiliations and beliefs, and the participants' lifestyles to ensure they were getting a good cross-section of the population. They found that while people who believe in paranormal activity are often portrayed in movies as uneducated and maybe even a little crazy, the survey also found those people who believe in paranormal activity could usually be broken down into one of two groups: those with a strong sense of adventure who believe in things like Bigfoot and ghosts, and those who leaned more towards self-improvement or self-enlightenment who believe more in angels, demons, psychic powers, and astrology. I think I would probably have to go along the lines of being the ones who believe that Bigfoot and ghosts are there and have more of an adventurous sense to them. But anyway, there's quite a bit more to this article there. I want you guys to go take a look at it. The book covering the results of their survey called Paranormal America discusses not only their statistical findings, but also recounts the tales of many of the survey's participants. Paranormal America, you can actually get it on Amazon. But anyway, I just thought it was really interesting that yet one more survey is saying that a vast majority of people, at least here in America, believe in the paranormal. Now, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of bbc.co.uk. A Noah's Ark site search man goes missing. A man searching for the location of Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey has been reported missing. Donald McKenzie from Stornoway on Lewis was last in touch with his family on September 30th. He was in his 40s and part of a Christian group looking for the site referred to in the biblical story. A friend raised the alarm after he failed to return as expected from a solo expedition on the mountain. That's why you never go on a mountain by yourself. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office confirmed that Mr. McKenzie had been reported missing, and the authorities are investigating. Staff are in touch with family and providing consular assistance. Noah's Ark features in the traditions of a number of religions, including Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. According to the Book of Genesis, it was built at God's command to save Noah and his family, and the Ark is said to have rested on Mount Ararat after the water from God's wrath had evaporated away. Explorers had previously hunted for the remains of the craft, but they had never really been able to find it. Apparently, there were some things out there saying that it really was there, some pictures and some satellite footage that actually say that it is there, but anyway, I wonder if there's any significance to him going missing. I wonder if somebody just killed him, if he just fell and died himself, or if maybe God doesn't want anybody to find out that Noah's Ark is really there. I don't really know. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on. The next article, again, is courtesy of bbc.co.uk, and a guy that was living in Ireland fled with his mother's corpse. The body of an elderly woman taken from Gatwick Airport by her son and driven unofficially to the Republic of Ireland is believed to be back in the UK. It followed a warning by an Irish coroner that the woman's body could be confiscated and put in cold storage if her son did not organize a burial. The woman, who is 91, died of natural causes, and she had been living with her son at a rented house in Kenmare, which is in County Kerry. Authorities believe that when she died, the man placed the coffin in a car and drove to Gatwick Airport without declaring the body at customs. They were alerted about 2 weeks later when the woman's body was discovered by the man's landlord at his rented house. It is believed the man kept his mother's remains for around 6 weeks. He then fled with the corpse back to the UK after he was warned that he must bury his mother. maybe he just didn't want to bury her. Maybe he just wanted to keep her around. Maybe he wasn't ready to lose her is what I'm thinking. But anyway, it's really sad to see that somebody would go that route. But in a slight odd kind of way, I can understand it. If you're not ready for that death to happen and you don't want them to leave and your emotions get the better of you, then maybe something like this could happen. I just found it to be really interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of abc.net.au. The oldest known stone axe has been found in Arnhem Land. A piece of stone axe found in the Northern Territory has been dated about 35,500 years old, making it the oldest of its known type in the world. The piece has a series of marks which archaeologists say prove it came from ground-edge stone axes. Monash University's Bruno David led the international archaeological team, which made the find during an excavation in Arnhem Land in May. Dr. David says the find shows the Jawoyn people, J-A-W-O-Y-N, were the first to grind axes to sharpen its edges. We can see with the angled light that the rock itself has all these marks on it from people having rubbed it in order to create the ground-edged axe. We already knew that the oldest evidence of axes in the world were in the late 20s of thousands of years ago. Very soon after that, we received a carbon result of 35,500 years ago for that piece. Dr. David says it is an important step in the evolution of modern humans. The two-week dig was held at the Rock Art Gallery on the traditional lands of the Jawoyn people. Now, I might be completely butchering that name, I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting that they found an axe that's 35,500 years old. Given what religion says as far as the age of the earth and the age of humans having been here, and given what carbon dating says, and given what science says, and all this stuff, it just really is confusing to me. When were humans first here? That's my question. When were they first here? Some religions say we were only 10 to 15,000 years old. Science says that we have the potential of being here for the past 100 million years. I don't really know. It's just really interesting to me that they're finding this stuff. I guess just because of my love of archaeology, I don't know. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of stuff.co.nz. And apparently, an earthquake has made more ghosts come around in New Zealand. The sheer strength and power of the September 4th earthquake has more than doubled the number of reported supernatural events in Canterbury, a paranormal investigator says. Christchurch paranormal investigators found Anton Hayrick said his team had received an interesting influx of phone calls and emails after the 7.1 magnitude earthquake, which more than doubled the usual numbers of inquiries. People are calling us saying they have always felt like there was something in the house, but since the earthquake, it had become more intense. Most cases related to strange noises, although one man says he had been attacked by a ghost. Hyrick says the sheer strength and power of the earthquake may have been responsible for the increase in paranormal activity. The number of old buildings damaged in the earthquake may have also been a factor. It is well known among investigators that when renovations on old buildings took place, it tends to wake up dormant spirits and activity tends to come out of nowhere. With the earthquake, it literally smashed walls apart and knocked down floors and ceilings, so you can imagine the effect that it would have. The team, which did not charge for its services, had conducted two full investigations and was planning to do several more. New Zealand Skeptics Chairman Gold said the reports may have been due to people's minds playing tricks on them in the post-earthquake environment. You may not feel an aftershock, but it will still make things rattle. People's minds fill in the blanks, and they tend to fill in the blanks with fairy tales, unfortunately. Now, is that true? I mean, yeah, there's a lot of post-traumatic stress after an earthquake. There's a lot of just stress in general with an earthquake, and your mind's going to be going a little bit in more different directions than it normally would on a day-to-day basis. I don't know. I mean, it makes sense that whenever you do a renovation to a house that it actually awakens something because you're changing what's in the environment of those ghosts from what they knew. So would the earthquake actually cause a heightened increase in paranormal activity, or is it all in the people's heads? I don't know. Either way, I just thought it was really interesting, and it makes me, you know, it just makes me wonder. It really does. It makes me wonder. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of io9.com. And scientists have discovered how to turn human skin into blood. Scientists at McMaster University have discovered how to transform human skin into blood. The researchers had previously used chemicals to transform mouse skin cells into neurons, but this is the first time human cells have been altered in this way. This process differs from modifications involving stem cells as it relies on chemical brew to transform the cells. Using the chemical mixture, the McMaster team was able to transform adult human skin fibroblasts into white and red blood cells and even platelets. Even though these modified cells are the same as human blood cells, it is unclear whether they will be useful for patients. Also, scientists have yet to discover how to create large amounts of these converted cells. Really, really interesting. If they're able to take skin and turn it into blood, at that point, I would be looking at it and being like, well, okay, we have a lot of people that don't donate blood in this world. There's always seemingly a shortage of blood to be used in circumstances where someone needs a transfusion. But would they be able to take, let's say someone would be able to donate their organs, but one of these organs would be their skin. Would they be able to donate their skin after their death, allow science to turn it into blood so you don't have to worry about donations so much? You can use the skin from donors to fill in the blanks for where the donations are lacking. I don't know. Either way, I just thought it was really interesting that they're able to do this. It makes sense that you can, just because it's part of the natural body. You should be able to break it down however you want with certain chemical processes. It makes a lot of sense. I just wonder if how much blood you could make from it. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of soundwaves.usgs.gov, and basically it's about the Blue Hole. The Blue Hole is a large underwater sinkhole off the coast of Belize. It lies near the center of Lighthouse Reef, a small atoll 70 kilometers or 43 miles from the mainland in Belize City. The hole is circular in shape, over 300 meters or 984 feet across, and 124 meters or 407 feet deep. It was formed during several episodes of Quaternary glaciation when sea levels were much lower. The analysis of stalactites found in the Great Blue Hole shows that the formation has taken place 150,000 to 66,000 years ago. As the ocean began to rise, the caves were flooded. The Great Blue Hole is a part of a larger Belize Barrier Reef Reserve System, a worldwide heritage site of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. The site was made famous by Jacques Cousteau, who declared it one of the top 10 scuba diving sites in the world. In 1971, he brought his ship, the Calypso, to the hole to chart its depths. I'd love to go there and visit this place if you look at it. It's absolutely phenomenal to see. It's just a deep, dark, black, perfectly round hole in the middle of the ocean. And it makes me wonder what it would have been like before water would have filled it up. Or actually, what I would have liked to have seen is the point when the water first started to rush in there and how long it would have taken to fill up. I just found it to be really, really fascinating because of all the sinkholes that we've seen lately that have come around, that the sinkholes that have been in California and in Texas and in all over the place where they're just seemingly popping up everywhere. Anyway, I just thought it was really, really wild. Let's go ahead and move on to the last thing that I wanted to take a listen to, which was a guy who apparently saw Bigfoot in Idaho.
Over the years, there have been hundreds, perhaps thousands of Bigfoot sightings all across the Rocky Mountain states. One of the most intriguing took place in southeastern Idaho, near Oxford Peak. The witness, Clint Josephson. The date, Labor Day weekend, 1980. Their objective that morning was gold, a day of prospecting that might bring a few dollars. But almost immediately, things seemed a bit odd. First, their horses were unusually skittish. Then there was the scream, an eerie, non-human sound. They saw something that just didn't make sense.
When we got to here, there had been about 8 to 10 logs, probably 25 to 30 feet long, maybe a little longer than that. But they were all laying in one direction. When we got here, the logs no longer existed. They were just pulverized. They'd just been shredded. And we took it for granted that a bunch of bears or a bear had been in here and grubbing the grubs out of these logs because they were just shredded, just torn to pieces. And it was just like sawdust all over the ground. And we tried and tried and tried to even get off the horses and lead them through to get over to the trail that goes up the hillside over here. And they refused to go. They got really super nervous in this area. As I was sluicing, Brian came over to the fence and yelled down to me, "Joseph, let's get the hell out of here." So I hurried and grabbed the sluice box and pulled the burlap out of it and prepped it to take off. By that time, he was down here. We loaded everything onto the horses. The mare was the calm horse of the two, and so Brian rode it because he wasn't very used to riding horseback. I had the Greenbrook colt, and he was really flighty. And so I had to hand my shovel and stuff to Brian. He took the shovels and started across the creek. I got on my horse and started to go, and it decided it wanted to drink. And it stopped and put its nose down in the water, was getting a drink, and I felt like something was looking at me. I turned and looked over my shoulder, and as I did, coming right down this open area right here where these deadfall are now, is where I saw Bigfoot. Anyhow, he came towards me. As he got closer, I could see that he had that burr stuck in his hair on his chest. He had a smear of something on his face, whether it was blood or could have been fruit or anything that they'd been eating around this area. And he just kept walking towards me. And I was in shock and just sat there and watched him for quite a while. I don't know how long, but long enough for him to get fairly close. And I finally was yanking on my horse and kicking him, trying to make him go. And as he got within about 20 feet of me, the horse apparently smelled him. And that's about the same time I smelled him. And it was a very putrid odor. And the horse didn't bother him to raise his head. He just took a lunge and went across the creek. But meanwhile, at that time, I had yelled to Belknap, "We got to get out of here." And he had seen my face for just a brief second through the shrubbery. And he said that my face was just white. So obviously I was in shock, and he knew that I'd seen something serious because of the way I yelled to him to get out of here. Those people that are disbelievers, I would just say, you know, you can have your beliefs. That's up to you. What I saw, I saw.
Clint Josephson is not alone. He's just one of a long line of people who claim to have seen the creature we call Bigfoot.
Now, I found it really interesting that the smell spooked the horse. Now, I've been around horses a lot. I know it takes, you know, sometimes very little and sometimes a lot to spook them. But for the horse to just bolt away like that, you know, the guy saw the creature coming to him. It was apparently in the middle of the day. I just found it to be really, really interesting that this guy saw this creature. It's funny how recently there have seemingly been a lot of UFO reports, a lot of Bigfoot reports, a lot of strange sightings of different things all over the world, sightings of things that you see in one part of the world, and then 2 weeks later you hear of seeing the same thing in another part of the world. And you see Bigfoot in Idaho, you see Bigfoot in Texas, you see Bigfoot in South America, in Africa, in Australia, with the Yowie, in Russia and China and everywhere. But yet, for some reason, we still don't have a lot of really good footage. Now, there is no footage of this guy's encounter with Bigfoot. Basically, it's just his story. I just found it to be really, really interesting. I don't know. I'd love to see bigger, better evidence come around. You know, we can always wish in one hand and shit the other and see which one fills up first, because I guarantee it won't be the one what you're wishing in. But anyway, you know, guys, I really appreciate you coming out and taking a listen to the show. I hope you guys have all been doing really well. Let's go ahead and take a little bit of a break here. When we come back, we'll close out the show.
Double, stand up for all its way. Why we are to stand by? What
boys and girls, guys and gals, ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate you coming out and taking a listen to the show. The next episode is going to be episode number 50. It's going to be a milestone. I never quite thought I would get to episode 50. There's going to be some things coming around, maybe changing a little bit. I know that I've wanted to do the free episode every 2 weeks. There might be some changes coming to that. As far as the format goes, I just wanted to add in more content. Like I said before, and I've said it again, this show isn't about me and my opinions. This show is about the content, the stuff that's going on in the world that's not covered in the mainstream media, the stuff that's going on in the world that you never really hear about, the stuff that happened this week, the stuff that happens right now, the stuff that you don't have to go around the internet looking for. I will bring it to you. If you ever find anything, send it my way. I love listener submitted stuff. If you ever have any experiences, give me a call, give me a voicemail, you know, shoot me an email, something. I love to hear from you guys. So anyway, all the formality stuff we covered in the beginning of the show, I hope you guys are doing great. Try to have a great day, night, week, weekend, whatever it is that you're listening to this. I will talk to you guys again on another day.